Welcome to the Digital Dialogue. This is Christopher Long, and I'm happy to be joined today by Joshua Miller, who is a PhD candidate in philosophy here at Penn State. And he's also an excellent blogger under the pseudonym Another Panacea. I guess it's a pseudonym, right, Josh?
Yeah, basically.
So, Josh, it's great to have you here. And I wondered maybe if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on, just as a way to introduce yourself. And then what we thought we'd talk about today on the podcast is the question of identity and memory. And that was something that you and I talked about over email. And I think there's a couple of important aspects related to the question of digital dialogue that those two topics relate to. So maybe you could talk a second about what you're working on academically.
So my dissertation is about Hannah Arendt, and she wrote a book at the end of her life called The Life of the Mind, where she tried to work out basically a kind of meta theory of the different functions that philosophy can play in public life. Mm-hmm. And she didn't finish that book. There was going to be a third section on judgment. And so I have this kind of this effort to reconstitute the unwritten, which I'm working on. And, I've spent a lot of time in the archives at the Library of Congress. And then I'm also interested in just sort of and have been working on and have basically completed work on how she sort of predates contemporary debates about deliberative democracy. The idea that what makes democracy most valuable is not elections and electioneering, candidates selling policies to voters, mm-hmm. but the fact that before we vote, we talk, mm-hmm. we deliberate, and we seek the truth and the just in those discussions. Mm-hmm. So, those two paths have I've been pursuing both of them and trying to get them to join for the last couple of years.
That's great. Well, I think there's certainly a lot of resonance with the kind of project here with regard to the question of digital dialogue. I know Arendt has a lot to say about Greek politics, perhaps maybe a little bit idealized.
Absolutely.
A little bit of an idealization of Greek politics. But in any case, there's a lot, I think, that can be said. So we may actually have you on here again to talk more specifically about Arendt and exactly that question of the nature of that discourse that belongs to politics and the way action and words, action and speech, to use her term, belong together all the time. Right. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, just to introduce us to this discussion of identity. We talked a few podcasts ago, I think, about sincerity and about how important it is in a certain way if dialogue is going to be really transformative to stand behind your words in a certain kind of way. But this brings up a real interesting issue with regard to digital dialogue, because it really is possible to be anonymous in your encounters. And mm-hmm. you had said that you began blogging and sort of got the courage maybe to blog because you didn't have to expose yourself fully as who you were, but you were blogging anonymously under the name Another Panacea, which I love. I love your blog. It's excellent to read. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that experience and why you did choose to be anonymous.
Sure. So I began blogging, actually, so I should just sort of fill in a detail. I began blogging on a community blog called Metafilter, where a lot of people contribute. And there, I was absolutely anonymous. I didn't really admit anything about myself. I tried not to share personal details, even to admit what part of the country or country I was from, to acknowledge gender or race. I would always just try to talk about, interesting things I found on the internet and various policy debates or philosophical debates or just debates in the humanities. Mm-hmm. And then, at some point, I guess in 2005, I started up this blog, and I preserved that anonymity because I was concerned as a graduate student that something, I didn't really know what it would be, but something I would say that I would expose would someday come back to bite me. Blogging tends to be it's very first draft a lot of the time, although increasingly it's become professionalized and we have high expectations of editorial control. Mm-hmm. It's the first draft of my thoughts, and I'll often want to try an idea out without having to be committed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're trying something out and somebody, you know, 10 years later comes back and says, you know, when you were just trying to figure out how, say, what freedom means or equality, right, or, you know, how we should think about some public policy matter, you said this, and right, they quote like half a sentence from something you wrote 10 years ago. That was scary. So I thought anonymity is the way to go.
Right.
And I think as I've thought about it more and as I've just developed as a blogger, you know, I've looked back and I've seen that, well, I think I can live with everything I've said. I don't think I've said anything too embarrassing. You know, I might have been a couple of times a little too snarky, right, a little rude, or, you know, made fun of somebody's ideas in the wrong way. And I'm sorry for that.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's actually interesting because it brings up the whole question of responsibility when you are anonymous. What happens to responsibility in that context?
Right, because you're absolutely right. Because a lot of people want to say that what it is about the internet that creates these horrible flame wars. You go on something like YouTube and you see people, the comments to a video will just be horribly racist, misogynist, you know, people saying the most horrible things. And there's no reason giving, or nobody's making any sense even.
Right.
They're not talking to each other.
Right.
And we say the problem here is that none of these messages are being attributed to the speakers.
Right.
So people just say whatever comes into their head.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that's wrong. I think that the problem is not that we're anonymous. The problem is that the medium that we're communicating in is the written word. And when we communicate in that medium and we don't know our interlocutor, we don't have any way of reading what they say, except for, you know, in whatever voice we make up for them in our heads. And we develop a real sort of narrowing of we can't quite understand the social cues that we pick up in the real world.
Right.
And so some people have called it the internet Asperger's syndrome. It's like we're all autists.
Right.
You know, we're all autistic online. And I think certainly anonymity plays a role there. But even if I know a blogger's real name and his profession and where he lives, that's not going to be enough for me. I actually have to have met him or her to have an idea of how to read her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I think there's a couple of things that are then wrapped up here. I mean, one is what happens when you are communicating in written words rather than in, you know, verbally, dialogically, or as if written words couldn't be dialogical. Obviously, we know they can be.
Right.
But there's certainly a different dynamic when you're speaking, as on a podcast or in discussion with people, versus when you're writing. And you can really feel, I can feel that certainly when I think about my interactions with people in person versus how I write emails. For example, you might write something slightly different, and of course, then when I put my administrative hat on, I'll be writing in a different way. So there's that. What happens with the written word, which I think we can also talk about in relation to memory too, probably. But I would like to maybe think about that in distinction from, or the question of writing. As different from the question of identity in relation to verbal or written expression. So
right.
I think there's a series of questions about responsibility and about a certain kind of embodiment or embeddedness that is lost when you are dealing with an anonymous interlocutor than you are, whether it be in written or verbal. So maybe we could separate the written stuff question for a second and just think about that, like the costs and benefits of being anonymous. I mean, you chose not to be anonymous at some point.
Right.
I agree, certainly professionally, there are real important things to consider about anonymity, especially if you're going to, you know, take some very poignant and tough stances on things. I read a blog that is about Penn State. It's clearly written by somebody who works here at Penn State, but it's very critical of Old Main, and it's an anonymous person.
Interesting.
So, and I can understand the anonymity there. And I guess you grow to know that person over the course of reading the blog, and they gain a kind of authority or a kind of respect or something over the course of that. But But what, so let's, what made you decide to take, no longer be anonymous?
Well, first, can I ask, what's the name of the blog?
I will post it. I can't remember the exact. I can't remember the exact name. I can find it in a second. But go ahead, and I'll have it in a sec by the time you.
Yeah. So what made me decide to sort of remove the veil was that I found that I was doing enough things as a blogger that I was proud of. You know, that sort of tallying up the few times that I had. You know, been overly snarky. I thought, I don't want to give up all the good stuff I've done for, you know, the couple of kind of rude moments. Yeah. And I think actually, it was also just to acknowledge, you know, this identity that I've created for myself is one that I inhabit. I don't want to drop it like a disposable cell phone or something like that. I want to claim it. I want to be this person that I've become and have performed. Right. This another panacea character. That's who I am. I've put so much of my identity into that. I don't want to give it up. I think that part of realizing that is realizing that it's not worth acting if those acts aren't going to be attributed to me or to the actor, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that's good about acting in the world that makes it valuable is that you appear as yourself, and you appear maybe more as yourself in those very public moments than you do in some of your private moments where, you know, you might where you keep your secrets or where you do the things you don't like to admit to people.
Right. No, I mean, what would you think? You're bringing up actually an interesting point. By the way, the name of this blog is called Left of Center, and Center is the center of Center County, Centre. And the person's name is, under which is blogging, is named Veblen. So
excellent.
Yeah, exactly. And I will post the link to the blog with this podcast. But the issue that you were bringing up, or the vocabulary that you were using and thinking about, sort of entering the public sphere with this persona or with your real person, your true self, is really Arendtian in its construction there. And I'm wondering how you would think she would feel. I mean, I don't want to get into how she'd feel about all this digital stuff. I mean, there's a complicated relationship, right. I'm sure. But what, you know, about her sort of position about the anonymity question? I mean, true political action, I would imagine, requires this kind of a certain kind of appearing in the public, right?
It does. I mean, but so if we. Here, let me just say a couple of things to introduce Arendt.
Okay.
And that's just that Arendt is a political philosopher who was writing. In the aftermath of World War II, thinking about totalitarianism, thinking about democracy, and trying to figure out what makes politics valuable. Should we prefer a world in which we have some kind of antagonistic political system to one in which communist administrators or Nazi administrators, you know, totalitarian bureaucrats determine the course of a state? Mm-hmm. And the thing that she seizes upon is this notion that what makes human life most valuable is when we have the opportunity to appear publicly before our friends and colleagues and strangers, mm-hmm. And to act, to say something or do something that bears on the course of, you know, our collective course, you know, mm-hmm. where you say you, she would say, you know, that bears on where we constitute in that action the regime that we inhabit and are governed by.
Right.
So here's what that means. It seems to mean that what's best about being human is to act, not to, you know, have a great romantic life, not to make a lot of money, but to, you know, act in the public sphere and to have people see you act and attribute that act to you.
Mm-hmm.
So when she says that you know, we should ignore the private lives of public citizens, that, you know, when we attribute to them their greed or their, you know, sexual affairs or things like that, right, that we've made a mistake. She's drawing upon this insight, right, that all that really, I mean, you can be a terrible human being, but what matters is what you do publicly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other stuff matters. She doesn't want to denigrate. She doesn't. It's not that we should like you or want to be friends with you, right, but the most important thing that you do is to, you know, say that an unjust law is unjust, or to fight for equality, or, you know, the opposite, right? To fight for inequality.
So, I mean, I imagine that she would, I definitely think she would have some very critical things to say about the way in which the digital web, let's say web 2.0 technologies, blurs the line between public and private, even between the public and the social.
Right.
But I do think that, I mean, I'd be interested to hear if you agree with this, that she would recognize the digital world as a kind of public sphere, or at least a possible way of appearing in public.
Oh, I think she would. Here's how I think this all bears on anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm really still trying to work this out for this is my next book.
Okay.
But my sense of it is that ultimately the desire to be anonymous makes a kind of category mistake. It assumes that what matters about our actions is that they are attributed to these private, you know, legal persons,
mm-hmm,
who, you know, so that if, for instance, we commit a tort, let's say we embarrass someone horribly online, mm-hmm, there are all these stories about people picking on each other and causing them to commit suicide, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we do that, we can be held responsible.
Mm-hmm.
She would say, first of all, of course, we should try to hold those people responsible, but that's not what matters about an action, because the thing that we want to appear, the one that we want to have attributed to the person, is the act itself, and that's how we get to know the person.
Mm-hmm.
So, really, whether or not you remain anonymous, you're still laying claim to the relationship between an actor and an act, right?
Right.
You know.
I mean, there, I think she, and I don't, for better or for worse, there is always this kind of nostalgic view of glory, right? This Greek idea of glory, that, you know, you're making a name for yourself in a certain kind of way. But I think there's a lot more wrapped up in it, and it goes back to the question, I think, of responsibility, and I would even say a certain kind of embodiment. I mean, if you are blogging and doing things anonymously completely, then, you know, it does tend to feel, you lose the richness of a more embodied kind,
yes,
of dialogue.
Sure. Yeah. You don't, I guess you might say, you don't ever have the opportunity to belong to a set community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You belong to your readers, whoever they happen to be,
right,
and to the people that you are in dialogue with.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this actually is related to, I talked, I think, a little on one of the earlier podcasts about this too, about my own sense of anxiety in some ways in trying to perform some scholarship online because of exactly how you began this, which was sort of,
right,
what do you do with the tentative nature of some of these ideas and their need to sort of incubate and be somewhat protected. On the other hand, my feeling is, you know, if you can expose them early on to a wider audience and maybe to some dialogical give and take, they could develop in new ways that I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated. So I'm willing to be a little bit risky about saying, okay, I think it's fair enough to say, look, I'm trying this out. Is this, what do people think about this? This is not my definitive statement. For my definitive statement, read my book, read my, you know, published article, you know.
Well, would you say that you self-censor in your blogging?
Yeah.
Or in your online? I mean, so there's something you want to say that, and you can maybe think of it and you're not going to say it now, but that, mm-hmm, you didn't feel ready to say then and you're really glad you didn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I the way I feel about my blog posts, about things I post to Facebook, about everything I put online, I there is a movement from the private to the public at that point. And I definitely want to be critical of a rigid distinction between public and private, but there's a way in which I'm always, when I'm posting, when I'm writing something, when I'm responding, even when I'm responding